Part 4. Reign of Regent Matwick, years 4 to 6. Chapter 29. Sutterdam, the Free States. Norling caught Thalen's eye and nodded her head at him, urging him to speak up. It was a good moment. The family relaxed around the table, having just finished a fine mid-meal of roast fowl topped off by one of Norling's berry pastries. His pater and mater had both enjoyed tall glasses of mead. Hake stared out the window, hoping to catch a glimpse of the pretty candlemaker who walked down Lantern Lane on the way to her shop. Even Harvan lounged, sated and momentarily at peace, wetting his finger to catch the last crumbs of pastry crust in the dish.
"Pater? Mater?" said Thalen.
He stopped to clear his throat.
"I would like your permission to enroll in the Scholarium in Fegat."
His mother sniffed and looked at Norling reproachfully.
"You've been encouraging him."
"Fetch my pipe, youngest," Hartling said to Harvan.
Then they all had to wait while the pipe was packed and lit, and Hartling got it to draw. After he blew out a mouthful of smoke, Hartling said to Thalen,
"Why do you want to go to the Scholarium? You just graduated from the Upper Academy. Proud of you, we are. Isn't that enough learning?"
With quiet firmness, Thalen said,
"The Scholarium has the greatest teachers. It has a library of 10,000 books. I thirst to know so many things. The answers lie with the books and scholars in Fegat."
"I know how bright you are," said Hake. "I know you could be a good calculator if you just put your mind to it."
Thalen understood that his brother had just paid him a compliment and that he meant well, so he tried to keep the frustration out of his voice.
"But I am not interested in how many casks of wine or reams of wool sell in a week or for how much profit. I yearn to know where the stars go during the day. Why salt and sugar dissolve in water but sand does not? Why did Armando start the War of the Priests? Does any of Iga's power of transformation survive? There's so much I long to understand."
"Would you leave those who love you, Middle?" said Maeta, with pain in her voice.
"Latham is not so far. I would visit. You would probably see me as often as you will see Harthen. When he joins the cavalry, he'll have to live in the barracks."
"But what about the fees, Middle?" his mother argued. "The Scholarium enrolls the rich, those who don't need to work to make a living and can spend their time pondering such impractical things."
Pater blew a smoke ring.
"Now, Indy, I catch the boy's craving. I recall when I was hungry to learn new glazes and to try new patterns. You're such a good manager, and business has been so brisk, I'm sure we could afford these fees."
"I have been saving for the lads' futures," Mater admitted. "But I doubt we have enough, and what would be left for the boy thereafter to start his real life?"
"I've solved this problem," said Teta Norling. "I sold the inn. I want to spend my profit on Thalen's education."
"Wait, no! Don't you want to save that? With that windfall, you'd be a great catch for a handsome new man."
His father was joshing his sister, but he was serious too.
"What I want is to spend it on Thalen," his aunt replied. "I want to ensure his future."
"But what kind of future is in it?"
asked Hake, who was always so practical.
"Once you studied at the Scholarium, how do you make a living? Do people pay you to find out about stars, birds, sand, or wars?"
"Would you become a counselor?" asked Maeta.
"Or a government minister?"
"I doubt it,"
Thalen shook his head.
"I think counselors get selected for their riches and influence, not their expert knowledge. Tutors are the only people chosen for their learning."
"What's a tutor?"
asked Haven. A scholar, a teacher for those who go on to study after upper school.
Would you become a teacher? Said Meta, considering.
It might be nice to have a teacher in the family. We could save on school fees.
Who needs to pay school fees now? Asked Haven.
For the brats you'll sire someday, said Hake, and Haven wrinkled his nose at the thought.
Now, eldest, you're the one most likely to start a family in the near future, said Meta.
Right, said Haven. You're the one always mooning over that girl.
Hake threw his napkin at his youngest brother. Mater, said Thalen, annoyed that at the moment when his whole life was at stake, his brothers were clowning around.
Teta says she'll pay for it, and there's nothing else in the whole of Aeneamond that would satisfy my craving.
Indeed, said his aunt, gnawing. Let the boy follow his dreams.
The room fell silent for a moment. Even Harvin kept still and held his breath.
Well, I can't see that trying out the Scholarium place would do Middle any actual harm, said Thalen's mother.
Peter tapped his pipe against the table edge to make it draw better.
But Thalen, you must not disappoint us now. We expect you home for every fest.
The next few weeks overflowed with the preparations, but his mother and brother managed all the details so the arrangements went smoothly. His teachers at the Upper Academy sent a letter to commend him, and a reply came that Thalen was allowed to sit for the entrance exam in a moon. Thalen had outgrown his clothes, so new ones had to be tailored. He packed and repacked one of Norling's old travel cases and a rucksack. The night before he left, his brothers gave him leave-taking presents. Hake had bought him his first neck drape, the long scarf that was a sign of maturity amongst Free State's men. Neck drapes had started as useful articles of clothing amongst labourers, who still wore long white strips of muslin to wipe sweat, cover their mouths against dust, or knot into impromptu bags. But Free State weavers had turned the garment into a key and stylish accessory.
Do you like it?
Asked Hake.
I want you to know that you're the equal of any nobleman's son.
It's so handsome, said Thalen, rubbing the gauzy fabric.
The shop had a nice brown one too, but Mater said to get the blue to match your eyes, and I think she was right, said Hake, pleased.
Haven handed Thalen a small box. Inside sat a pipe Haven had carved out of maple. On one side of the bowl, he had etched a perfect bird, and on the other, a cluster of stars. Thalen didn't smoke, but he was touched to know that Haven had been listening to his questions about natural phenomena. Peter bristled when he examined the fine craftsmanship. He started fuming again that Harthen's real talents would be wasted in the cavalry. One more present remained to be unwrapped. Norling gave him the flute they had played together for many years. Speechless, Thalen hugged her close. Peter invited just Thalen to accompany him to the local tavern, the Weighted Scale. After the server had brought them their mugs of hard cider, he passed several coins across the scarred tabletop.
I want you to have some spending money, Middle.
Thank you, Peter, answered Thalen, putting the coins away carefully.
Having money in your purse makes a man feel secure and stand tall. The only other thing I can give you, son, is a bit of advice my father gave me when I was starting out with my pots. Always look people in the eye. You learn who to trust and who is shifty. And the people you are in business with will learn to trust you. Of course, I'm talking about suppliers and customers and workers, not an upper academy. But I imagine people are people the world over.
I don't know what purse to put that advice in, but I will keep it safe,
Thalen replied. Hartling nodded with a grin, and they finished their cider in companionable silence. On the day of the journey, Thalen woke up even before his mater. Norling gave them a packet of food wrapped in paper and tied in string for the journey.
Maeta dressed in her fancy gown and a hat with cloth flowers around the brim.
Thalen thought she looked young and pretty. They took a long roads cart from Sutterdam to Trout Landing, the station for the ferry that crossed the broad, clear lake. The trip across the lake lasted half a day, so they relaxed in the sun and fed breadcrumbs to the lake's fish. Jorinda chatted with other travellers while Thalen studied the patterns of the water ripples.
Why do some fish live in salt water and others in fresh water? Why is Clear Lake so clear? What stone lies on the bottom of it?
Why do some ripples flow one way and some another? How long has Clear Lake been here?
About midway across the lake, seasoned passengers pointed out a special sight. On a hilltop dominating the northwest shore, one could just make out a jumble of pillars and rocks.
What is that? Mother asked.
One of the ferrymen responded,
That there is where the castle of the king stood. Long ago, them kings and their followers lived up there with the lake as their view from their front balcony. During the bloody revolution, you know, it was sacked.
On the far shore, coaches waited to take passengers to various destinations. Maeta and Thalen found the right vehicle for Latham. By the time they arrived, they were bone-weary and the streets beyond the carriage stop yawned pitch dark. With a pickiness that exasperated and embarrassed her son, Jorinda declined the inn the coachman recommended because she thought it wasn't clean enough. But after stumbling over rough cobblestones and waking up cranky landlords, she eventually found a lodging that suited her. In the morning, Thalen set off to find his exam site. His mother decided she would visit merchants and chat with them about Sutterdam Pottery's wares. The scalarium itself was easy to find, and no one challenged Thalen as he walked through the gate onto tidy grounds where stone buildings stood arranged in a circle. Thalen found it odd that their rooftops were painted in a pattern of alternating black and white. An old porter led Thalen to a room where four other would-be entrants also gathered, two other young men and two young women, all more fashionably garbed than he, even though he wore his blue neck drape. Thalen, overcome with shyness, could hardly summon up polite words of greeting. Thalen found the exams on logic, geography, nature and history quite easy. He struggled with the one on the arts of beauty and silently blessed Norling for teaching him music and his father for what he had picked up about ceramics. Ancient languages Thalen knew nothing whatsoever about. It made sense that different countries had developed their own distinctive speech before trade and travel had led to the development of the shared tongue, but his academy had not exposed him to this topic. Thalen left that part of the exam blank, wondering if that might preclude his entrance as he snuck out of the room where the other candidates were still furiously writing away. When he joined his mother at the Quill and Ink Inn for a hearty supper of pigeon pie, however, he assured her he had found the test manageable. She was in a good mood because she had enjoyed her day in Latham.
It's just a small town, Thalen. Mostly set up to serve the scalarium, she said. There's one wine shop that wants jugs, and the inns ordered ewers and bowls, but I had fine chats with friendly people.
She had already spent the money that these commissions would bring in by picking up little presents for his brothers and a fine comb for Norling.
If I failed the exam, I will work at the scalarium or here in town as a servant while I study up on these languages.
The next morning, Thalen told her she could safely leave him, which she did, after filling him with warnings and advice. Thalen didn't know whether to go out or stay in his inn. Finding a book, Historic Sites of the Free States and What Transpired Therein, on a shelf in the parlour, he sat down with his long legs stretched out across a braided rag rug. The next thing he knew, it was mid-meal time, and Thalen took his book into the tavern area to keep him company. In the early afternoon, the porter came to find him.
Rector wants to see you,
the man said, jerking his head in the direction of the Scalarium.
Thalem followed him to Scholar's House, a grand marble building. The porter led him to a hard bench outside a chamber and told him to sit.
One of the girls from yesterday, the thin, pretty one with multiple silver rings and bracelets, sat there too. They acknowledged one another warily. The girl had brought a book in her bag. Thalem wished he had been so foresighted. After an anxious wait long enough for Thalem to count the white marble tiles in every direction and study the grey and tan striations in each of them, the door opened. The rector turned out to be a woman of middle age, with dark ringlets, dressed in an orange and white striped skirt under a black doublet. She also wore colourful earbobs of starfish painted orange. Her jolly smile warmed a rotund face.
We'll start with you, Thalem. Come in, come in, she said. I am Rector Meeky.
He entered her spacious chambers and sat across from her cluttered desk. She said, looking at papers in front of her.
Thalem of Sutterdam, son of a potter. Did you know that you got perfect scores on four of our exams?
Thalem did not know that and had no idea what to say to this surprising information, so he kept silent.
Sutterdam Academy is not really first class, she continued confidingly. Hasn't been for years. So, do you mind me telling you how you did it?
I don't know, Madam Rector. I just knew the answers.
But how did you know the answers?
Well, for geography, I just see the map in my mind and draw in the names of the cities and countries.
So you memorized maps of the known world. And for history?
I've read as many books as I could find on history, so for each of the questions, I consulted the relevant book.
Consulted?
Meeky frowned at him.
And for logic?
Well, the questions were pretty simple, don't you think? I mean, there was only one rational way to consider each problem.
I do not know that, Thalem. Logic would tell me that an artisan son with middling schooling should not perform so well on our Scholarium exams. But you can't have cheated because we drew up the tests just the night before. Let's try a little experiment on you, shall we?
She started madly sorting through her books.
Thalem had bristled at the suggestion of cheating and the slurs on his background, but he gathered she was not trying to give offence, but rather studying him as if he were an unusual specimen.
Help me find Sistium's whale migration routes, won't you? She asked. It has a grey cover.
Thalem spotted it under a jawbone as big as his arm.
Good. Now you cannot possibly have seen this before because I have the only copy.
She stared off into space absently.
Sistium was one of my tutors so many years ago. Rather nasty man, prone to making students cry, myself included, I'm afraid. But what a magnificent work of scholarship. Does that make up for his personal deficits? Now there's a question to ponder, but not right now. Right now, I would like you to look at this map of the whale's journeys for a moment.
She opened the book to a page and allowed Thalem to gaze at it for half a minute. Then she took the book back and paged to a list of the 187 known bones in a narwhal specimen. She let Thalem look at that page for half a minute too. Then she asked him to write down what he remembered from both pages. Thalem did as he was bid.
A perfect memory, said Rector Meeky. That is useful for a scholar. That's how you consulted history books.
May I ask a question, Rector? Why do the whales follow that exact route? And how do narwhals' anatomy differ from that of other whales?
You've asked three questions, she replied.
And they were off on the subject of whales,
pulling out more books and drawing pictures on the floor with chalk. From whales, somehow they moved on to porpoises. After a while, Phelan heard a rap on the door.
"Madam Rector," said a new servant in the tone of a parent chiding a wayward child, "another applicant has been waiting in the hallway all afternoon. Shall I send her home for the night?"
"Oh, dear me, how very, very rude of us. Phelan, you never should have let this happen. Send her in, send her in. What's her name?"
Rector Meekie clapped a chalky hand to her forehead.
That's right, Gusty."
Gusty walked in as Phelan was attempting to rub away the chalk drawings with a rag. Her expression conveyed both annoyance and amusement.
"Gusty of Weaverton, how wonderfully gracious of you to wait for us. Really, you've been most kind. Now, don't you ask me about porpoises, or we will all miss our dinner. You two have been accepted. You start tomorrow. One of our older students will fill you in about the library, student lodgings, and so on and so forth."
Phelan almost asked the rector about his poor showing on ancient languages, but thought better of it. The rector walked to the door to call out to the servant,
"Whom should we assign to be their mentor?"
The servant answered, "Quinneth, madam. You have said that Quinneth is simply a genius at acclimating new students."
"So right, I did. Now," she clapped her hand to her head again, leaving more chalk dust fingerprints, "I really must dash away. I just remembered that I have a whole gaggle of students running an experiment, and if I don't supervise, the whole thing will go awry. Welcome, Gusty. Welcome, Phelan. Here. Our students each get these wristbands. I promise we will talk about seals another day."
She ran off. Phelan joyously fastened on a wristband of braided white and black leather, but he felt terrible about Gusty's long wait.
"I'm sorry," he said. "We got to talking, and she knows so many things, and I forgot about you. May I buy you supper to apologize?"
"I'm not sure it's your fault," she said. "The rector seems somewhat addlepated."
"She's rather enthusiastic, that's for sure," said Phelan, marvelling that this brand new student would be so blunt about a rector.
"Waiting around always makes me hungry," replied Gusty. "Dinner would be lovely."
So they walked back together toward Latham's taverns. Phelan asked polite questions. Gusty turned out to be a wealthy silversmith's eldest daughter, obviously accustomed to speaking her mind, which was evident when she complained to Phelan, a very recent acquaintance, about her stepmother's ability to
pop out a baby every year.
Phelan liked her best when she spoke about her fascination with ancient languages. Then her face softened and her manner became more patient. Phelan asked her to explain her interest to him. She complied over a celebration dinner of ham and stewed greens at the Reader's Tavern that ate up most of Phelan's pocket coin.
"But all the ancient languages have now been replaced by the common tongue, right?" asked Phelan.
"Not completely. If you know where to look, you will find that we still use some words. Take the term enaimon. What does it signify?"
"Enaimon is what we call our known world."
"Yes, but the term comes from ancient Lorther and ancient Rorther. Literally, it translates as the world of the nine."
"You mean eight, don't you? Religious people count eight spirits."
"Well, maybe long ago people confused Enea and eight. But you're missing the point. Terms you think stem from the common tongue actually have older roots."
The next morning, a young man inquired for Phelan. Quinneth was slightly pudgy, but his well-tailored clothes downplayed those pounds. His manner was so friendly and organized, he reminded Phelan of his brother, Hake. They picked up Gusty on the way to campus. Quinneth explained that at the Scholarium, pupils did not attend classes. Instead, they chose subjects they wanted to read and scholars to guide them.
You are interested in sea life, I hear, Quinnis said to Thalen, trying to control the smile that tugged at his lips.
Not particularly, or not exclusively. We just got to talking.
The tutors here are so absorbed in their fields, they tend to sweep students along in their wake, Quinnis replied.
He counseled the newcomers to think hard about their own interests. He himself studied music. He showed them their dormitories and arranged for their trunks to be fetched. He guided them to the refectory where they would take their meals.
Tell me, Quinnis, Gusti said, why do we wear these wristbands?
White stands for emptiness, for ignorance, and black symbolizes fullness and knowledge. We braid the strands together and wear them on our wrists as a constant reminder. The more you learn, the more you discover your infinite ignorance. The tutors wear them, too.
He led them to the middle of the grounds where a marble building stood.
And that's why the scholars named this the Library of Humility, so that we all keep our lack of knowledge in mind.
Inside, shelves filled with books of all sizes and bindings reached from floor to ceiling. Students were permitted in the building at all hours. Lanterns, chairs, and tables had been placed in various nooks. Students were reading surrounded by piles of books, with quills behind their ears or on the tables.
Thalen pulled out volumes at random.
Rotherod's Stories and Legends. The Magic of the Rotherod Kings. He rubbed the book covers reverently.
You've got it bad, said Gusti.
Got what? Thalen asked.
Epistemophilia, she answered, drawing out each syllable.
Love of learning. It comes from ancient Dorian.
There's a word for this yearning?
Thalen grinned. He turned to Quinnis.
How do you decide which field to concentrate in?
Most students browse for a while, Quinnis answered. Then you find that you can keep coming back to the same stacks that those books call to you in a special way. I've heard it said that students don't choose their subjects. The subjects choose us.